Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering an exciting announcement from the Great Lakes Museum about the SS Keewatin.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. The Great Lakes Museum has announced that the SS Keewatin has been selected as the 2025 Museum Ship of the Year by the Steamship Historical Society of America, SSHSA. The Keewatin, an Edwardian-era passenger steamliner, was acquired by the museum in 2023 and opened to the public in May 2024. The SSHSA is a nonprofit organization founded in 1935 that now has thousands of members. Their mission is recording, preserving, and sharing the history of engine-powered vessels for education and research purposes. The Keewatin was nominated for this award by SSHSA members and chosen by the organization's awards committee. Great Lakes Museum Executive Director Beth Shippers shared her initial thoughts when she heard the news.
We were thrilled. We were absolutely thrilled that we were chosen by the Steamships Historical Society of America for this award. They have members that are international, and there's thousands of members. So the fact that we were nominated and then chosen by them was really kind of awe-inspiring for us. We are thrilled mostly because of how it acknowledges the hundreds of people that have been working hundreds of thousands of hours over the past many years, you know, tirelessly renovating her and promoting her through public educational programs. And we also, you know, are thankful because it also, recognizes that the community that's been supporting the ship and the museum, contributions from donors and foundations and governments and local organizations that also support us in kind with materials and labor, you know, all of which working towards her preservation and the success that she has as a tourist destination. And, you know, getting the recognition for that has been really special for us all.
Shippers also dove into the work staff, volunteers, and board members have been putting in behind the scenes.
The ship will be a labor of love for many, many years ahead. When she arrived in October 2023, there was probably up until the weekend we opened for tours, people were working every single day for probably 10, 12 hours a day, working on, you know, new carpets, renovating, like repainting and working on handrails and revarnishing, like the number of things that were being worked on. I can't even explain them all. There's so many. Everything from fixing up the engine room. The engine is spotless. They spent so much time cleaning her up and making her very presentable for the public so that we could actually explain what they're looking at. Also, I would mention the hundreds of hours of the staging crew that went through and itemized all the artifacts that are on the ship. So everything from clothing to records to instruments, magazines, silverware, everything that's, you know, that came with her. And staging her to be presentable as though you were a passenger walking on. So you have that feel of the passenger experience. It's been a lot of work.
The museum celebrated the recognition on Saturday, July 26th.
We had members from the SSHSA come down, and that's the Steamship Historical Society of America. So members of their board came down. We had Ted Hsu was here, our MPP. We had the deputy mayor. We had board members. Community people came out from across Kingston. Lots of staff and volunteers were here. was like a really nice celebration.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Morrisburg Leader, Philip Blanchet, about the closure of the Morrisburg Beer Store.
Thank you, Jesse. It is the last call for Morrisburg's beer store location in the Village Plaza. The Main Street retail location is part of the latest in a string of announced closures across the province following the expansion of retail alcohol sales. In 2024, the provincial government announced an overhaul of retail alcohol sales, which expanded beer and wine sales to convenience and grocery stores similar to arrangements in Quebec. Ontario's agreement with Brewers Retail, or the beer store, was signed in 2015, which continued a monopoly on sales outside of limited agency stores and the LCBO until 2025. Brewers Retail is owned by AB InBev, Labatt, Molson Coors, and Sleeman Breweries, including Sapporo Breweries, and has over 6,000 employees. Founded in 1927 when Prohibition ended in Ontario, the beer store has been largely the sole seller of beer in the province outside of the LCBO. Beer and wine sales in South Dundas have expanded to one grocery store and at least 8 convenience stores or gas station locations, including 2 en route service centers. In addition to beer sales, the beer store handles empty returns. Starting January 1, 2026, grocery stores which sell alcohol must also accept returns. The Morrisburg location will close September 28th, with 6 employees affected by the closure. John Nock, president of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union Local 12R24, confirmed the Morrisburg location has 5 unionized workers, 1 full-time and 4 part-time, and a non-unionized manager. The unionized employees can go to other beer store locations or take severance. The beer store has averaged an announcement every 3 weeks of new store closures, with an average number of 11 stores per announcement. At its peak in 2023, there were 437 locations in Ontario. Morrisburg is one of more than 40 location closures announced so far in 2025. Brewers Retail, the beer store, has been open in the village since the 1930s. And thank you to Philip Blanchard for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LGIR reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about Gananoque Town Council's decision to transform the Kinsman Building into a childcare facility.
Thank you, Dinah. Gananoque Council voted unanimously to support a proposal that would bring up to 49 new childcare spaces to the community, while also ending a long-standing lease agreement with the Thousand Islands Youth Boxing Club, which currently operates out of the same building. The decision, made during a closed session of council on July 15th, marks a significant shift in the town's use of the Stone Street facility, the former Kinsman Building, signaling a renewed investment in childcare infrastructure. Council directed staff members to proceed with the Canada-wide Early Learning and Child Care Plan, or CWELCC, targeting an opening date of December 31st, 2026. As part of the plan, Council approved an extension of a contract with Bell & Associates to update architectural drawings for the expanded facility. The next step will see the proposal forwarded to the United Counties of Leeds and Grenville and the YMCA, which currently oversees childcare operations in Gananoque. In a separate vote, Council passed a bylaw to officially terminate the lease agreement with the boxing club. The club will not be charged rent from July 1st to October 31st, 2025, at which point the lease will end. The Thousand Islands Youth Boxing Club will host its final class on Thursday, July 31st from 6 to 7 p.m. The club thanked their members, sponsors, volunteers, and supporters, saying that the club had been more than a gym. It was a space where friendships were built, confidence was developed, and youth were empowered, both inside and outside the ring.
Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to the LJI reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the expansion of Loyalist Township's Community Tree Initiative.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Loyalist Township Council approved the continuation of the Community Tree Initiative last week with consideration for expansion. Staff are now looking to bring back a funding proposal for the 2026 operating budget. The program supports climate goals, including the planting of 20,000 trees in Loyalist Township by 2034. The program was originally made possible through a $15,000 community grant. In its first year, grant funding supported the purchase of 125 trees by residents. Trees were valued between $165 and $175, reflecting a discounted rate the township received through bulk purchase. Residents paid $25 per tree, and the grant subsidized the remaining cost of the trees. The follow-up survey showed 100% of respondents recognized the benefits to the community. Most participants expressed interest in participating again, and over 75 residents signed up to be notified of future tree programs. With hopes of expanding the program, staff has recommended increasing the number of trees available each year, dependent on program uptake and success. The recommendation would be 250 trees in 2026. Deputy Mayor Nathan Townend showed his support for continuing the program.
The program is great. I do think it should be expanded. I think it conforms to our strategic plan. That's obvious, particularly with respect to our climate action plan. And I think we should find the means to continue to fund it through our usual budget process, which we do for all of our other items that come under our strategic plan.
Councillor Paul Broderick explained why he thinks the program should go through the budget process rather than a community grant.
By putting it through the budget process, we sort of have a better opportunity to look at our needs and what we can afford at that time.
Councillor Jake Ennis disagreed and explained why he wouldn't be supporting the motion.
I'm not going to support the motion. I think it's the type of thing that should be supported by the community grants policy, and I would like to see what staff would come back with as an option there.
Ultimately, the motion was passed, and the program will be funded through the 2026 operating budget. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE, Brenda Little, with a story about an ostrich rancher in Prince Edward County.
I'm here with Brittany Denowden, and we're feeding ostriches. These big youngsters are sticking their heads through the fence and gobbling up the grains. Brittany is co-owner of Streusvogel Ostrich Ranch in Prince Edward County and is one of only 20 female entrepreneurs across Canada to receive a visa grant. Brittany and her husband Caleb produce red ostrich meat that is high protein and iron, low fat and cholesterol, and is packed with vitamins, nutrients, and essential fatty acids. Sticking with their sustainability mission, everything from the flightless birds is used, including hide and feathers. I chatted with Brittany about the ranch and her recent grant award. Brittany Denowden, tell me why you call this farm the Streusvogel.
Yeah, it is Dutch. It means ostrich in Dutch. My husband has some Dutch background. And we spent a year in South Africa, and it was the Dutch immigrants in South Africa that introduced us to ostrich farming for the first time. So it's kind of an ode to the Dutch.
And so how long have you lived in the county?
I have lived in the county since, that's a good question, 2011. And my husband grew up in Frankfurt. Uh-huh. And then once it was probably 1999 maybe, then his parents moved into the county, and so then he grew up in the county since then, actually on Rennersville Road here where we are now. So he grew up since high school on this road. So once I met Caleb and we, after a year in South Africa, we settled back here in his area where his family was from.
And when did you start the ranch?
We started in 2020. Yeah, so we had lived in Consicon before and in Caring Place before, and then when this property came up for sale, we knew there was enough space to have our ostrich.
So why ostriches?
When we spent that year in South Africa, mm-hmm. we visited the largest ostrich farms in the world, and they are there. And we didn't go there to see ostrich farms, but we happened to stumble across them there, and we ate a lot of ostrich meat while we were there, and the ostrich meat was just the best meat we've ever had out of everything we tried. We tried just about everything, like kudu, crocodile, boar, all sorts of different meats, and ostrich stood out as just the best. And so we would eat it when we were at restaurants or different places. We'd pick ostrich because it was so good. Mm-hmm. And then after visiting the farms down there and doing like a tour similar to ours but much more established, we came back to Canada and we couldn't stop thinking of our experience there. We rode an ostrich, we stood on an ostrich egg, learned all about ostrich farming, and 10 years later we just kept thinking about it and thinking about it, and it just never left our minds, and we thought we got to try it one day. And so bought our first ostriches and tried it out.
So how many did you have when you started?
We started with 10 little chicks were about 3 months and under. And then we bought some, I think we started with 4 adults ostriches, all bought from the same farm in St. Eustache, Canada. And then in Quebec, Canada. And then we bought a few more birds from the States at different farms. Once that went well, then we were like, we need a bigger gene pool for our breeders. And so then we bought a few other adults from other farms. And then once we had that going and we started incubating and hatching ourselves, then it just explodes and you have 100 birds in no time. And so then now we don't need to buy birds anymore. No. And now people start buying birds from us.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's nice. So what do you do here exactly?
So we do everything. Like when you're a small farm, you kind of do everything. So we raise the birds for meat, but then we also breed birds as well. So then we're collecting eggs, we're incubating eggs, then we're hatching our own baby ostrich chicks, and then we're growing those chicks, and it's just like a whole like cycle here, starting right from the incubating process right up to like the breeding. So a little bit of everything, but meat is our main focus at the farm, is to sell the ostrich meat, because it is a really healthy, sustainable red meat. So we're all about the meat, but in keeping with the sustainability mission, if we're going to process them for meat, we want to use all parts of the bird. So then we also use their hide for leather, their feather for our feather dusters. We make all sorts of different leather products now with the leather, so purses and belts and bags and stuff. And then the oil, we have a skincare line now using the ostrich oil. We try to use all parts of the bird.
And it's a tourist spot.
And yeah, also now a tourist spot. Yeah.
Yeah.
We started out with just selling the meat online, and then we had a lot of people kind of knocking on our door, want to check out what's going on, and if they bought the meat, they also wanted to kind of visit the farm. And so then we realized we need to open this up because a lot of people are interested. So yeah, then it became a tourist destination.
And so tell me about this, the visa grant. How did that come about?
Yeah, we apply to different grants here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them don't work out. But I'm always kind of applying to different ones. This one was a really great opportunity because it was just for women. And then it was one that you could use for any part of your business. A lot of grants are focused for one thing. You can use it for marketing, or you can use it for like one sign or this or that. This one was very open, which is great. So we could use it for any aspect of the farm that we needed. And so it wasn't too hard to apply for. You did have to spend some time doing a promo video. But once I did that, I was lucky, I guess.
And you're one of only 20 in Canada that received that.
What are
your plans for that?
Our plans is just to keep growing the farm. So we need like a new area for like chicks. We'll probably, we already have started using the fence. So we've already built like new areas for our chicks, and they, the more chicks we hatch, the more different areas we need. And so helping for them not to trample on each other, basically. So I think what we'll do is, corner off new sections for our chicks, maybe build another little shelter. So many options.
You have quite a sized property. How many acres do you have?
We have 72 acres.
72 acres, wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you would like to add?
We always... We always, I guess, like to add that we encourage other ostrich farms. So we know we can only do so much in our lifetime. And so the more ostrich farmers, the better it is, and we can collaborate and help each other. So we always encourage people to look into ostrich farming. It's a really unique farming opportunity. And we hope that there's more ostrich farms in Canada and in Ontario in the future.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about the planned replacement of 3 long-term care homes in Brighton.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. A massive new long-term care facility is being constructed on the outskirts of Brighton as the province and municipality look to combine 3 smaller facilities into a new 256-bed home complete with modern amenities for a community feel. The project has been years in the planning and development stages, requiring land availability, permitting, and zoning approvals by the municipality prior to shovels in the ground. Construction is already underway as the foundation is being built. As more seniors enter care, Brighton Mayor Brian Ostrander says 256 beds may not be enough to meet the demand in his community.
It may not be enough at the end of the day, but it's going to be a massive long-term care facility build for our community. It will increase the capacity for long-term residential care in the area because it's combining three existing homes into one, but also increasing the number of beds available. So we were just incredibly pleased that Omni chose Brighton as the site for this redevelopment, and we're happy to see it happening.
So talk to us about timelines on some of the construction. I see there is construction going on, concrete, foam. What's the timeline to get this project really off the ground and going?
Well, like any massive building project of this nature, it's going to be a couple years, so we're expecting a 2027 grand opening.
Now, in terms of the planning on your part, this must have been a couple years in the making to start discussing permits, location, design. Just walk us through that.
Well, the location was really Omni's decision, and the landowner who owned this parcel of land who made it available to Omni to purchase. It's right in our built boundary of the community, on the outside of our built boundary, but certainly in the serviced area, so it makes a lot of sense that we'd put a facility like this in this location. I've been texting and calling Minister Piccini for probably 3 or 4 years about this project, knowing that there was something in the works and wondering when we were going to be putting shovels in the ground. So today's a really good day when we're able to stand together and say, let's get going.
So on the back end, council planning, staff planning, what did you have to do to clear the hurdles out of the way to start getting the shovels in the ground?
Well, you know, as with any planning project, there's site plan approvals, there's rezonings that were required, there all sorts of those kinds of consents through the planning department. We have an incredibly nimble staff who worked closely with Omni and the ministry to get that red tape out of the way and get this project going. So incredibly thankful to the staff for doing that hard work and that heavy lifting, and incredibly thankful to council who sees the benefit in a project like this in our community and said yes.
Now let's talk about the building itself. We heard there's going to be a barbershop, there's going to be a lot of amenities, visiting rooms. But more importantly, it sounds like it's a building that's going to be a community, not kind of the old saying, it's kind of like a warehouse, but more of a community feeling. Yeah. Is that what you get from this design?
I see more than just a roof over people's heads. I see that we're building community here in Brighton in this facility. It's going to have a chapel, it's going to have visiting rooms, it's going to have, as you say, a barbershop. So yeah, it's going to be a community unto itself, and rightfully so for the residents who live here and may need those needs much closer to home than the rest of us do.
Now, staffing's always been an issue in the healthcare sector. Are you confident that you'll be able to meet the demand to get this building open?
Well, I'm confident that Omni has the skills to make sure they're hiring the right people for the right jobs, and I know that the Ontario government's working very hard on that skilled trades file to make sure that those people are here in Northumberland, here in Brighton, and here across the province of Ontario.
Now, when you talk about the three buildings being kind of merged into one, does this account for future possible needs? You might be able to expand to another building or add a floor or whatnot. Is there the future needs assessment done to maybe accommodate more than 256 people?
I wouldn't anticipate that there would be an expansion. This facility is taking up most of the square footage that that you see around us here today. But I do know that the province is working very hard on similar rebuilds elsewhere. So we know what the capacity needs are, and we know what the demographics look like from a provincial perspective, and I'm confident that the province is working hard to make sure that these facilities are up and running for our senior community.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
Thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, August 7th, we're going to see a daytime high of 26, feeling closer to 30. However, just humid, no haze from wildfire smokes in the forecast for Thursday, August 7th. Friday, August 8th, 27, feeling like 29, a hot, humid, sunny, and ultimately quite beautiful day here in the city of Kingston. Moving into the weekend, Saturday, August 9th, daytime high of 28, feeling closer to 30. Sunday, August 10th, high of 28, feeling closer to 33. It's going to be a hot Sunday here in the city of Kingston. And then into the start of next week, Monday, August 11th, daytime high of 29, feeling closer to 32.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering. Thank you.